And welcome to the newest episode of the Read Right to Left podcast. I am G, joined by my always wonderful co-host, Ray, from Whimsical Pictures.
Hi, guys.
And today we are doing a series spotlight for the month of April, a series that is much beloved, not only between us, but I think kind of across the board. Today we're going to be talking about Witch Hat Atelier. But before we get into what this series is specifically, for all of you who are listening, you can follow us on pretty much every podcasting platform, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, as well as my YouTube channel. We've gotten a lot of listeners. We thank you all so much for that. And if you do enjoy this monthly podcast, we do appreciate any reviews and ratings you do leave. So without that out of the way, let's get straight into it. I think this is a series that we have a lot to talk about.
So Witch Hat Atelier by the very accomplished illustrator Kamome Shirahama. This series is, to give just a little summary, it's about a little girl named Coco in a world where, as far as she knows, and as far as anyone, any of the other muggles, non-magic users know, they call them outsiders. You know, it's a world where witches are born with magic, and only witches can use magic. But what Coco discovers when she's given a mysterious picture book by a strange figure with a creepy mask and tries out some of the spells in it, she finds out that this is not true at all. Anyone can learn magic. Anyone can perform magic just by drawing seals using the right ink. And she finds this out by casting a spell that turns her mother into stone, which is one of the forbidden spells, because the world in centuries past was completely ravaged by the hubris of witches who used all manner of magic to transform the human body and lay waste to the lands. Now, like, any spells that alter the human form, like that, are forbidden. So this one that turned her mother to stone is also forbidden, and so would be the magic to turn her back. Coco ends up being taken in by a witch named Kifri, as one of his apprentices, along with three other little girls. And he agrees that even though it's really a big no-no to bring in an outsider to the world of witches and magic, he agrees to teach her how to use magic anyway, because he's got some ish of his own. After that, it's Coco learning about the world of magic. It's sort of us trying to uncover the ultimate goals of the Brimmed Hats, who are sort of these witches who are determined to bring the forbidden magics back into widespread use. And it was a Brimmed Hat who gave Coco that book. It's a Brimmed Hat that ruined Kifri's life. From there on, it's mostly like various things happening related to that, so...
Indeed.
Yep.
As Ray said, this is a story about Coco as an outsider kind of learning about magical society Both the very positive impact it has on people, but also the very tumultuous history and the kind of ongoing clash between doing, because witches are meant to be working for the greater good of humanity, and that's sort of how they, or at least the pointed caps, because there are two factions of magical witches here, as Ray mentioned. We have the pointed hats and the brimmed hats.
Which is like kind of, you know, part of this whole like PR reform campaign on the part of the pointed caps to be like, we're not hiding anything from you guys. We are like, our intentions are to help people. We have no ulterior motives whatsoever. We are not like the brimmed caps who hide their faces from the world with a wide brim on their witch hats. In fact, it's against our laws to even have a brim on our caps. So.
But Coco, as an outsider, as someone who hasn't been raised in this magical society and therefore just assumes or takes for granted the laws that have been put in place to mitigate some of these past issues and to prevent further corruption of magic, she starts to see some kind of cracks within this facade. She sees a lot of the hypocrisy around some of this magic as well. It's a pretty nuanced look at how fundamentally, like, a lot of these stories about kids, like, discovering magic, there's a lot of wonder and awe, and at some point there's the, oh shit, maybe this isn't so perfect after all, point where that you get to in these stories. Comparatively to other titles that deal with this sort of thing, I think there's a very... So early in this podcast, I hate to make the Harry Potter comparison, but it always comes up. Everybody drink, take the shot, because this, from day one, this was a series, well, probably within two volumes, this is what this series is always been compared to. It's always given as a recommended alternative to the horrible turf magic series, especially now that that series does have such bad press and that creator is such a horrible person, for people looking for age-appropriate kind of fantasy, magical school type stuff, something that evokes the same feelings that a lot of people of our generation who grew up with the Potterverse felt whilst, you know, with Harry Potter, growing up with it, movies, books. Now this is sort of a nicer and more inclusive and just better, well-rounded style of story that gives that same kind of feeling to younger people.
Yeah, I do feel like, as I was, like, catching up on... Well, I reread the whole thing for this podcast episode, but as I was reading through it, and getting into the later volumes, it's like, almost feels like a response to, like, some of the more fundamental political issues that a series like Harry Potter has, which is sort of its inability to imagine a better world could be possible. Which, you know, if you get into, like, you know, the turf lord's you know, personal politics when it comes to, like, you know, Tony Blair stuff and everything, her particular brand of milquetoast liberalism, like, it makes sense that we just get this fundamentally unequal world in Harry Potter that nobody ever seems to consider changing.
Or, challenging at all.
Get laughed at for it. You know, you have that fundamental hypocrisy within Harry mm-hmm. Potter that it's like, oh, everyone should be equal, but also some people have magic powers and some people don't, and the people who don't have magic powers should never know about the world of magic and never be able to use magic to help their lives. Even though magic can do these amazing things within Harry Potter.
And all of those non-magical people, I mean, magic could help with their lives so much, but fuck them. Like, why would we even want to? How dare? How dare you even suggest?
They would just ruin magic, honestly. And that's, like, kind of, like, you know, they're going to attempt not to put it in so many words, but it's kind of the pointed cap's ideology.
Yeah.
You know, some of them aren't necessarily to a place where they realize that's what they're saying, but, like, we certainly, like, that's is what they're saying. And the series is very much like, oh, so you're saying that, you know, say, the poor just don't deserve magic because they would make it dirty? Is that what you're saying? Because that's what I'm hearing.
Is that what you're saying? Because that's fucked up, honestly.
Like... So, like, this series is not just political, but, like, revolutionary. Like, it is here to incite some shit, and that's awesome. Yeah, we'll get into all that stuff, but I appreciate it as a counterpoint to Harry Potter. Specifically because it's like if you're giving it to a kid to read, it's like it's telling them that like change is possible and often necessary, and that they have the power to change things. Like I think that is so empowering for anybody, but especially like young people, especially in this age group who are like in their sensitive period for social justice. To use my Montessori buzzwords. But, you know, who are in a place in their development where they really care about justice and making the world a better place and figuring out how they can have a part in that proactively. I think the series is so good for that. I think it is,
And also allowing... or showing child characters, like, actually questioning the systematic issues within society that, again, some people who've been raised in it or who benefit from it don't question because, well, they benefit from it. But just because something is in place, and maybe what was put in place for a very good reason, you know, 100 years ago... maybe now it's time to reassess and change those things, right? Like, that is within your people's ability to do. And I think it's really important that it shows that kids do have that power as well. I think it's really, really well-balanced in showing that, you know, there for a lot of these child characters, not just Coco, but the other girls within... Queer Free's Atelier, they all have very strong personalities. They all have different things that they're very into and that are important to them and matters to them, but they also all have this kind of you can see them grow, right? They're children, but they're not stupid. Like, they recognize that there are bad things in the world and bad things are happening to them sometimes. And, you know, sometimes it takes the creativity of a child as well to recognize that there's maybe a better way to do some things, you know?
Yeah, creativity and, like, their perspective as people who didn't, you know, grow up with some of this stuff. I appreciate how this series frames, like, adults from a child perspective as well.
Yes. Yeah.
That, you know, there's, like, there's adults who are, you know, people who they love and trust and can trust and should trust to keep them safe. And there are adults who are not that, but that no matter like who we're talking about, whether it's their teacher or their teacher's boyfriend, you know, the Knights Morales, they are encouraged, like, they question, like, the points of view of all of these adults, and are encouraged to do so. And I feel like a big, like, difference between some of the adults that are sort of presented as being antagonistic to the girls' goals, and, you know, the ones that are, like, helpers and mentors in their lives, is that willingness to just, like, trust them to question things, and kind of come to their own conclusions. Because that's a big thing with Kifri, is, like, even though he has his own, like, ulterior motives going on, he's very much got things that he frankly wants to use Coco for. Even though he knows it's wrong, he, like, can't give up on this for his own reasons. Like, what makes him, like, a good mentor and a safe adult for the girls is that he trusts them to make decisions for themselves. And he's just there to sort of make sure that they can do so safely. I really love him as a teacher character, which I'm sure we'll get into more. But, yeah. And with that, is there anything general that we want to add to that before we get into the quite a few questions that we got this time? Or are we good to...
The only thing I would say in addition, or before we jump into specific questions, is another, like, obvious thing that always comes up when we talk about this series, or when the series is discussed, is the art style is beautiful. As Ray said, Kamome Shirahama is a very accomplished illustrator and artist. And it's not only reflected in just how creative, like, even just the paneling is, it's done superbly, but the importance of art and illustration in the series itself, as how that facilitates magic, is a really interesting reflection, I think, on that. So it's, you know, Shirahama's a fantastic artist. We could, you know,
there's a lot of themes running through the series, art and, like, being a young artist, definitely among them, especially in early volumes, but later on as well. The style here is Shirahama, again, being a very accomplished illustrator. She's known in the U.S. for the variant covers that she's done for a lot of superhero comics. She's got a Wonder Woman cover in particular that has gone around the internet quite a few times. The style for Witch Hat Atelier really fits the content. It's super storybook. It has a bit of a Ghibli feel at times. There's a lot of, like, decorated borders around the panels. Super pretty. It's just gorgeous. No complaints about the art whatsoever. One of the best drawn series coming out right now. And really creative designs, like, not just in terms of, like, the human characters and the different, I love looking at the little nuances and all the different witch hats and their witch cloaks, but also, like, some really creative animal designs. I love the Murfons so much. Just little penguin griffins. So cute.
They're so cute.
Beautiful, beautiful series.
I wanted to get the, like, obvious things that people mm-hmm. always talk about with this series out of the way at the forefront.
I think we'll be talking more about the art style a bit later mm-hmm. with some of these questions. I think we'll start with our unofficial moderator at Storied Shelves. Gives us quite a few questions, as they often do, which we mm-hmm. always appreciate because it helps us have a bit more direction in our talk. First question, simple question. Who are your favorite characters? Who are your favorite characters, G?
I love them all. I know that's a cop-out, but... Coco is a phenomenal protagonist. I really, really think she is not only well written, but just well realized. She's very fun to read about. She's very, like, she feels like an actual preteen. She doesn't feel like she's written to facilitate what needs to be done in the story. Her rationale or the way that she works through things is very, very well done. I think when we're talking about, and I like the rest of the girls across the atelier. I like Tarta a lot. He's very sweet. The young boy who's an apprentice he's sort of a medical apprentice initially.
He works with his grandpa.
Grandpa. Yeah.
Well, he sells pens. He sells wands. Mm. So he does mm-hmm. apothecary type things, but like very key point in the series is that witches are not allowed to touch the medical arts at all.
Do not no medicine. No medicine whatsoever.
But he deals with like herbs and herbalism mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. The inks that are used for casting spells, because magic wands are pens in this universe, and spells are like created by drawing seals mm-hmm. with a special ink. So he is very versed in herbalism because he has to know all the different ingredients for the different dyes that are used for inks.
Which causes some tension, which I'm sure we'll get to as well. But I do really like Tarta. He's a very sweet boy. And it was nice to have like a recurring male character in the cast as well, around mm-hmm. the like Coco and Agate and the girls their age. Mm-hmm. Kifri, as mentioned, he's a fantastic mentor character. He's very interesting, certainly an oddball. And of course, El Rugio, who's sort of also an oddball, but has his feet planted a little more firmly on the ground make sure. So sometimes
he tries to keep a workaholic.
Absolutely.
And barely holding his own body together.
I didn't say he was functional, but when Kifri has his head in the clouds.
He's functional when it comes to taking care of children. He's just not mm-hmm. functional when it comes to taking care of himself.
Which is not unrelatable, right? Like
certainly.
Mm-hmm. I mean there's a lot of side characters as well. I really, really like Belderut, who's one of the three wise witches. He's very fascinating. There's just as I said, I like everyone, but I mean if I'm really narrowing it down to specifics, the main cast is fantastic, very, very strong, and just there's no character that pops up in the series and I'm like, oh god, oh, I've just got to skim this chapter. Not interested in them.
Yeah.
What a What about yourself, Ray? Who is your favorite characters?
Well, I do love everyone you mentioned. Especially since I'm like training to be a teacher as well, like Kifri means a lot to me. Old Raggio is just super sweet. Of the girls, like I love all of them to pieces. They were my own daughters. But I particularly like Agate and Richay a lot. Agate's like, I think she, like she's they're all really well-written preteens, but I really like in particular her sort of ongoing struggle with kind of jealousy and wanting to fit in and wanting to be the very best like no one ever was. I think a lot of the kids that I'm teaching right now are in a phase of puberty where they're fitting in socially is like everything in the world to them. And like, you know, they get so jealous of each other, but then they feel so bad about feeling jealous about their best friends. And it's like I remember being, you know, 12 and feeling that way too. And it's not like these, like, I want to clarify, it's not like we don't have these feelings as adults too, right? But it is a very like 12 thing to feel, you know, like it is overwhelming when you're that
Absolutely.
age, like those
It's like
pressures.
my emotions are so big they can't fit in my tiny body of just so I'm just gonna have to You
And
don't
you're
know how to
like,
deal with
I'm just trying to be the best person that I can be, but I don't know how. And all this angst keeps getting in the way. And like, I just think Agate is such a wonderfully written character in that age range. I think her character design is super cute, with the
Very.
short curly hair. I love her friendship with Coco. I like that they've got enemies to friends energy going on because initially Agate's like the Malfoy. She's like, ugh, an outsider. This is a waste of my time. But like watching them warm to each other because Coco's just such a wonderfully open and kind, curious person, is so sweet. Richay too, she's like the other. Richay is the one who's like, yeah, that was me when I was a kid. I was very much one of those, it's my style kind of artsy kids. So and you know, didn't grow as much as I could have as an artist, because I was so stubborn about like not losing what made my art mine. And I think it's something a lot of young artists struggle with. And I think that it's represented very well, very accurately, in a very nuanced way with Richay. I also like this series makes me cry pretty regularly, but to date, the biggest waterworks session that I've had with the series was the whole arc with Richay and Yuini, who I also love. He's so cute, and he made me cry
I
so
wasn't
much.
that whole arc just messed me up, man. I'm still not over
It destroyed me, and I loved it.
it.
Yeah, there we have like a counterpoint to like kind of a safe understanding like mentor figure with like the kind of teacher that like ruins kids' lives like just stamps them down and makes them feel
Destroys
like
their
they're the scum of the earth.
self-confidence.
out of their own insecurity. We've all known teachers like that, so I've worked with a few. Yeah, so he, I love him too. I love his like little shadow cloak design, and when he turns into a wolf, I love that design too. And let's see, I also love Tarta. Let's see, I'm trying to run through characters.
I hope we see more of Juji. She's spunky. Yeah, I like
she's
her.
Great. I love her design. She looks so good. Yeah, there's like quite a few like more supporting and side characters who are characters of color in this series, but I'd really like more of them to take a spotlight. So yeah. It's kind of a case where it's like Canary from like Hunter x Hunter, where people like take like an image of her and like spread her around like social media and stuff. Like, this is how you design black characters, and it's like, okay, but she's been in like two chapters.
Right. Like, she's
yeah,
been, like,
her design
fine.
Is
Come
incredible.
On.
Her design is incredible, but like, has she done anything yet? But yeah, I hope she gets to do things. I like her mentor too. He seems funky. I really like our like morally ambiguous dark duo of minstrels.
Yes, yeah.
Dagras and Custis.
Yeah.
Yeah, another two who made me cry. But
yes,
really love the sort of progression with Custis's character.
Yeah,
it's really interesting, really nuanced. Yep.
Yeah,
I'm curious to know more about the creepy little prince.
Yeah,
he's interesting. Yep. But I mean, it all comes back to the four main girls, right? They're just adorable and wonderful, and I love their friendship. And like,
you wouldn't have the series that you did without them, right? And their dynamic, the dynamic of the atelier, just in general, both the girls and their mentors. I think it just creates this really rock solid foundation to grow off of.
Yeah, it also, like, it gives the series, like, a comfy home to return to when things get really dark, which,
which
I think
do.
Especially, like, if you're recommending this for a younger reader, like, upper elementary or middle school, that really is going to be important, because the series does get, like, dark.
Yes, yeah.
It gets bleak, man. I certainly wouldn't recommend the series for below, like, maybe 4th, 5th grade. I think if you get any younger than that, you would scare them. Which I think people kind of, like, look at the covers of the series or the title or the premise, and they're like, it's kind of like a Ghibli movie. You could give this to a kid. And it's like, careful. Like, an older kid. Maybe.
It kind of is like a Ghibli movie, and it'll cause them irreparable trauma.
Yeah, but see, it's more like Spirited Away and less like
Ponyo.
It's like mid-series Harry Potter instead of like early series Harry Potter. That one definitely, Harry Potter's like first two movies do have some traumatizing moments for children though.
Oh, for sure. But see, the idea of the wonder of magic was still fresh in the early series. Once you got more into it just was like, oh, okay, this is just what we're doing now. Like, we're not awed or excited to see magic anymore.
Okay, but which Hat Atelier always has like time for some moments of just like wonder, which I
absolutely
really
love. That's what I'm saying. That's a huge positive point for Witch Hat Atelier. Mm-hmm. There's always this wondrous, which is good again because sometimes it's easy as well to forget that Coco is new to all of this shit, right? Like she is mm-hmm. just sort of still being introduced to the magical world. And so us as an audience, I think, can get caught up in just being like, oh yeah, magic. And so the fact that Shirahama does actually take the time to reintegrate the fact that, no, magic is wondrous and unusual and mm-hmm. awe-inspiring and just really, really special, which is something mm-hmm. that I think a lot of magic series, whether it be Harry Potter, whether it be other manga, stuff like that, kind of forgets once it's established itself. You just become used to it, right? It's like, oh yeah, this is just mm-hmm. magic now. It's just magic, except magic. And you're like, okay, well, what about all us damn muggles who can't do magic? What about us? It's still wondrous and interesting, and it's worth exploring that.
All right, are you ready for our next question?
Absolutely.
At Story Chills says, how long could you see the series being? I don't know, 20 volumes?
I'd say about 20 as well. We're currently at 11, and the story is really ramping up. I would say between 15 and 20 volumes. 15 seems a little short. Probably closer to that 20 volume mark is my best guess. And it's one of those things where like it's sort of like I just want it to go forever, but I also don't want it to outstay its welcome. I mean, I doubt that Shirahama would spiral it into something unrecognizable by the end, but with all good things, you know, all good things must come to an end eventually. Plus, we do have a wonderful spin-off series, which is even cozier than the main story. And if we are correct in that 20 volumes is sort of the sweet spot for the series, you can always revisit the gay husbands and their cooking adventures in the atelier.
Yay!
Yay, indeed.
What is the name of that spinoff again? Which is called Kitchen?
Kitchen, yeah. It's by Hiromi Sato, based off of Shirahama's characters and world and everything. I spoke about it in our top 5 debut episode last December. But it is, if you're a fan of coziness, of domestic manga, of food manga, then you will, it's just good. Plus, or if you just want more Witch Hat Atelier, it really feels like it slots into the world and the setting and the characters just really easily. It doesn't feel like a tacked on extra bit moneymaker, you know?
And there's definitely some food porn in the main series, so it feels like a natural spinoff to have. Okay. Next question. What would you like to see develop in the story? We already mentioned wanting to see more of Juji.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like for me, the series, like, has set up quite a bit that I trust it to pay off, so
yeah.
it's kind of already directed us as readers towards the things that are going to be developed more for an ultimate payoff, and I trust in the flow of the story to deliver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's how I feel.
And yeah, there's a lot of various threads happening. As said, it's a story that does encourage Coco as our main character to really question this new world that she's so enamored with and so excited about, that I think just with how everything's been handled thus far, I put my trust in Shirahama, and I don't think that that trust will be broken or disappointed. There's a lot that's, as Ray said, there's a lot that's been introduced that, also this story, like, builds off of past, like, it builds and builds and builds, so even though, like, a small part will be addressed in one thing, it then creates another opportunity or another question, which I think allows, as Ray said, the flow of the story to feel really natural. And as a reader, you don't feel like you're being led on to be given a disappointing answer at the end, like some series.
I do hope there gets to be a payoff for those, like, two, like, gay witches.
Yes, yes.
I felt sad that they, like, introduced a gay character as his partner, and then immediately tragedy befell him.
Yeah, I feel like this is the one thing I'm like, if they don't get a happy ending, I swear to God, I'm going to commit a crime. Yeah. I don't know.
Shirahama's, like, you know, posting, like, LGBT stuff on, like, her Twitter and everything, so I'm going to need her to not bury her gaze in 2024. I'd also like to know more about the other two of the three Ys.
Yeah.
Because we know quite a bit about Belderoot. But I like the other two as well. They both have cool designs. So I would like them to be able to do things other than politic for a chapter or two. But there's a lot of politics to go around, so... next question is more of a comment. It says, but I miss the character science from early chapters. Understandably, I get how time constraints impact the artist / team. Personally, I actually liked the character designs more as the series went on. I felt like they got more consistent and more fleshed out, which is usually what happens. Like, I feel like I have a better feel for the image and silhouette of each of the characters. That's my opinion, though.
I maybe this is just reflective of me being an art noob, but, like, I didn't, you know, it. There's a consistency thing always when characters in manga are ongoing and the evolution of the character, but Shirahama's world is just so rich with detail anyway that I don't feel like there's been a noticeable drop off between any particular like from the premiere first chapter to now. I feel like I'm still reading this incredible fairy tale, beautifully done, rich fantasy story. And again, maybe it's because I'm a pleb and don't understand the nuances of art, but I love it. It's great.
That's the thing, is, like, I feel like I don't think there's been, like, a drop off in the level of detail in, like, the backgrounds or those lush paneling layouts or the costume design. I just think that the character designs have been streamlined so that, like, they are easier to make consistent from panel to panel, which I think just comes as part of the process for someone as experienced in character design as Shirahama. Like, I guess you could say that that makes them more simple, but I would use the word streamlined more so. But that's just me. Yeah, there's definitely not, like, a drop-off in quality or anything, I don't think. And honestly, I think rereading the series, I probably wouldn't have even noticed so much an art style shift if I hadn't had this question in my head while I was reading the last couple volumes. But yeah, I think like those character designs just sort of got tightened into their ultimate final forms. Which happens in any manga.
Then
they ask for favorite chapter cover art. I didn't really have an answer for this. I think all the chapter cover art is really, really impressive, and I'm always like, I turn it to the page and I'm like,
oh my god, pretty. Yeah, so beautiful.
And then I turn the page into the actual chapter and I'm like, pretty. I feel like the series itself is so gorgeous that, like, the chapter cover art almost doesn't stand out as particularly special because it's just the same level of quality as you get in the rest of the series.
almost, like, I don't want to say almost worse, but because of how dynamic the paneling is sometimes, like, a single page frame art is like, oh, you know, that's beautiful. Wow. But then you turn the page and you're like, oh my god. That is amazing.
I do like the ones, I guess, where like we see like the bad ending brimmed hat Coco.
Yeah. Oh, she has such a cool design. Honestly, I feel like the pointed cap, which is really lost. I mean, the uniforms and their outfits are very lovely. But there's just something so cool about having a brim on a witch's hat. Like, that's just so iconic. And I'm like, man, I feel like you guys are missing out. You guys lost the war in Slay because have you seen some of these brimmed caps? They are...
Well, I think the whole point is that they wanted to, like, step back a little bit in Slay.
I know!
So they weren't as intimidating.
I understand, but, like... When it comes to fashion, Ray, we know that I take this extremely seriously. And out of the two, I think brimmed hats just look more Slay. It just looks more Slay.
A little less Maid Marian.
Exactly!
But the pointed caps are so cute, especially on the little girls. Next question, favorite and least favorite story arc so far. What's your least favorite story arc so far?
I don't know. I don't know if I have an answer for this. I don't know. I feel like that's a hard one. I truly couldn't give you probably an answer. Maybe like something really early on. There's some stuff with Coco doing the trials that are foundation, like they're important and they're world building and they're foundational to her getting like being introduced to the initial part of this world, but when compared to like other stuff happening since it, they're weaker, but they're not bad. Like, and I wouldn't even say that they're like my least favorite story arcs. They're just more to the point.
Simple.
Yeah.
I was thinking like the river when they have to save Custis
that's,
and Daggers.
That's exactly what like came to mind was there's that. There's also one with like the sand bank thing. The
dragon.
Yeah.
And it's like they're fine though. They're just kinda like set up. So it's like not as exciting as once the world's more established, but it's still like they're still really well written. It's still really vital for establishing the relationship between the four girls. But Yeah, and also, like, introducing our villain more concretely. In the case of the Sand Dragon one. But yeah, it's, I don't know, not really, there's no bad arcs so far, so.
Yeah.
what's your favorite?
This is also hard. Current arc is really interesting, very intriguing. I think for, like, completed arcs, maybe, man, the arc with, Uni, that, as said, fucked me up. I don't want to say it's my favorite, but it's one that, like, really hit hard.
Yeah.
And that really, yeah, resonates. The ongoing arc with Custis right now is very interesting. I'm intrigued to see how, well, not intrigued, but I just know it's gonna mess me up. I'm gonna cry. and then obviously there's, like, personally, I think that the trial with Beldurt and Coco, you know, completing that trial with him, or surprising him, was very well done. But it's hard. They're all good. They're all good. What do you want me to say? Like, I can pick a point from, like, pretty much every arc that I'm just like, this was masterfully done, and it's phenomenal, yeah. And I'm so surprised at, like, how consistently good, not just good, fantastic the series is all of the time. But, yeah. Yes, sorry. Continue. I don't mean to interrupt.
I'm gonna be stereotypical, but the arc with Yuini is my favorite so far, if I'm picking one that's, like, complete. Yeah, it just means a lot to me on a lot of different levels, and I just think lore-wise, it's one of the more interesting ones, with the whole, city of gold statues and the Serpent Road, that they have to traverse, that, like, part of, like, the duty of the Pointed Cap Witches is to sort of keep ecosystems going that were disrupted by magic. In this case, the creation of this, like, fucked up winding road with, like, super crazy gravity has made it impossible for the Merfauns, this, like, these penguin griffins, to complete their migration without the help of witches to guide them across the road. And so they've turned that into sort of a trial for apprentice witches, that sort of yearly duty of helping them to their migration grounds. Yeah, it's just so good. There's so much in it that's, like, hopeful, and so much that's harrowing.
Yeah.
Makes
you sick to your stomach. It's just
makes you sick to your stomach. There's some, like, really good, like, rich, lush, gothic shit going on in the arc that is, like, just delicious. You know I love this. We know I eat it up.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah, that's a Ray arc. That is a Ray arc.
Right, that arc makes me feel like that meme where it's like, hey, look how hard I can cry, and then it's just, like, spraying tears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, so. Then the next question here is, how do you feel about the story where it is currently, if you're caught up? We are caught up to the
collected volumes. I am, at least.
Collected volumes in English. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So we're both caught up in terms of being through volume 11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are other chapters, I believe, on Kodansha's, like, manga digital platform. Mm-hmm. But he and I'm not doing that. I can't. I physically can't do that. So, you know.
Yeah. And it is one that I'm following in English, so I'm not following it in Japanese. Mm. Shockingly. This one I feel like would have a lot of annoying jargon in Japanese. And I would be like, about this that is life. Taking too long, and I throw it across the room. It's a seinen series, so probably doesn't even have furigana. I'm being such a baby, regularly reading novels in Japanese, and I'm like, mm-mm, no furigana, no deal.
Not today.
anyway, but yeah, so we're caught up with the English release of the collected volumes, so through volume 11. Mm-hmm. And we've already kind of both said, but the story is in a really good place. We're like firmly within the rising action. Everything's ramping up. Things are getting darker. Things are getting more intense. Mm. Everybody's got keeping secrets from everybody else. There's a little bit of romance.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, what do I even say? Like, it's got everything. It's in the perfect place. Mm-hmm. I just, like, if they kill those gay witches, I'm gonna throw my book into a fire.
Yeah.
Or put the one in Prison Island or whatever.
Mm. Yeah, oh man.
Next question. What elements of the world / story have you enjoyed seeing? So how about the world? Like, what's your favorite aspect of, like, the world and the lore and the world building so far?
I really like the magic system in this series for one. Like, I think the magic system is not only really creative and not only really suited to comics, right? Like, this is very much mm-hmm. a magic system that wouldn't have been, I don't want to say it wouldn't have been possible, but it wouldn't have been as effective if this was a novel. This is very much something that was that is helped and facilitated by the fact that this is a comic.
An image popped into my head of, like, a novel that, like, includes, like, visual representations of the circles, and that would be cool.
But yeah, there are certainly ways to do it, but I think that the fact that this is, comics are fundamentally, like, a piece of art, an illustrated piece of art, the fact that magic is created through illustration, for lack of a better word, through drawing, is just very, very key to and unique to this particular series. I don't want to say, like, I also really appreciate the fact that magic isn't, like, you know, some blood rite for, like, very particular people, right? You know, there's obviously Harry Potter, that's the whole thing, is that some people are just born special, and it's every magic, like, that's for a lot of, especially children's media around magic, it's like, oh, and then this normal kid, this kid who is a little bit of an outcast, who just thought they were normal, you know, whoever, discovered they were special the whole time. This
they
is
were
really, like,
the special one.
Exactly. They were the special one. They're better than Stacy, who goes to church with her. You know, it's...
Fuck Stacy.
Exactly. Fuck Stacy. She has no idea. She thinks she's so hot. How dare... I'm actually the better one. This is...
Her mom, though, has got her mom.
But this series I mean, we do have this level of, like, magical society being removed from quote-unquote normal people, but, and that's almost entirely because of the issues that happened in the past and the corruption of magic and the idea of, and perhaps the flawed idea that you can't give, you know, overwhelming power to everyone because people will ultimately use it for bad, like, as good of a tool as magic can be, or as helpful of a tool as magic can be. When everyone has access to it, quote-unquote, then bad shit happens. But then again, it opens up that idea of, like, well, you know, that's always going to happen, and regardless of whether you keep it clustered away to a small percentage of people, or everyone's able to use it. But point is that Coco is not, like, fundamentally more special than anyone else. Any of the other little girls from her village. She just happened to stumble into something that opens the door to her realizing that magic is a very accessible thing, fundamentally. Like, it's not, oh, you have to be born a certain way. Oh, only these sorts of people have access to it. In structurally, yes, that's correct, but it's not the actual facilitation of magic. You don't have to have your magic pure blood to be a witch, which is not the case.
It's hegemony.
Mm-hmm. In Harry Potter, or like the Worst Witch, which is another like very British witchy type of series. but there's a lot, like, really there is a lot. The only, my favorite, when we talk about like fantasy and I guess young adult fantasy, maybe, i.e. the one who did it first and the one who still does it best, Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea Cycle. That's still, and for as wonderful and as diverse and as critical of, like, magical society as that series is, it still does have to have, like, the main character still is different, does still have that, you know, chosen one kind of, you are the special person. Mm-hmm. You show talent, therefore we send you to magic school. Whereas this, in Witch Hat Atelier, it's basically like, oh, well, anyone can do magic, but we're not actually, like, we don't think that that's appropriate for society to know. It's too powerful for people to know. Therefore, only a small group of elite families have access to magic, which is very reflective, I think, of a lot of things. There's a lot of allegorical stuff you could make reference to there, but it's just, that's sort of my favorite part, because it's just the magic itself, like the drawing, is really cool and interesting and perfect for the series, but also what it represents within humanity and society, and how it facilitates the relationship as well between witches and non-witches. It's just, oh, it's good. Plus, all the animals are cute. All of these weird little hybrid animals, they're wonderful. Also, I just really like some of the magical, because Orugio in specific, he makes a lot of, like, magical devices, and I find those really creative and interesting as well.
I was gonna say, I love the contraptions a lot.
Yeah, they're so cool, and I'm like, oh man, that would have been, that's so helpful. But like the idea,
so many kids dream of being like inventors. So get to see, like, these kids making all these cool magical inventions and selling them themselves. It's, like, the perfect kid power fantasy.
Yeah. Oh, man, I mean, I'm just a big kid myself, so I'm in heaven. It's so good.
Yeah, I am in perfect agreement to the point that I don't even have that much to add. So I'm just going to move on, because I feel like you covered my favorite parts of the world. Again, I also love, like, whenever we get sort of glimpses into the days of yore, as we keep calling them, when magic was used by everyone and was often used for nefarious purposes. Well, mostly, you know, like war and colonizing and oppressing. And I mean, part of the reason I really like that, like, City of Gold statues so much is that it's interesting that it's, like, this example of this civilization that ended up falling, essentially, because it started determining who and who could not be a part of their society, turning them into gold statues in their case. But in the case of the pointed caps, it's, they do the exact same thing, except instead of, like, turning people into fucked up statues, they just wipe all of their memories to the point that they're, like, practically lobotomized.
Yeah.
And send them to prison island.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry about it. We will re-educate you. Don't worry about it. And you're like, but that seems very worrying.
That seems like exactly like what the people of yore did, actually. Exactly the same. Weird.
Exactly. Wow.
The next question is the last question from at Storied Shelves. Says, what do you think makes Witch Hat Atelier so appealing as a starter series? So this series, I think, gets recommended quite often as a series for people new to manga, especially young people new to manga. I think to some extent it has a very Western sensibility. Like, it feels like it could be, like, a Western, like, an originally in English, like,
yeah,
children's fantasy novel. So I feel like it's not all that far off from what a lot of, like, young readers are obsessed with anyway. it's got the sensibility. Also, the art style being very storybook, I feel like it's not, you know, aggressively quote-unquote manga. So
yeah,
kids in particular aren't going to be like, why does this book look so weird? Because kids can be really picky about things that they haven't seen before, right?
Yeah.
I feel like this is edging them into, you know, a whole new world. might be like, those aren't, like, you know, you might hear those reasons and be like, ugh. But, you know, sometimes people who are just getting into manga are, like, a little overly weird about the whole, you, it's from another country thing.
Yeah. So. Plus, I think, like, if we're talking about a recommendation, especially for younger readers and children, this is just, like, a very, I mean, there's fucked up shit in here, but there's no swearing, there's no, like, uncomfortable fan service, there's no weird child nudity, there's not a lot of quote-unquote manga bullshit that you have to deal with,
yeah,
with other series, even stuff that is written for kids, because especially like the, and I hate to say this, but like the American sensibilities of very, very puritanical about sexualization. Yeah. There's nothing that
to
could
the
be
point
deemed...
where I was like, I was rereading volume one, and like in chapter one or two, there's like, you know how some of the panels are just like decorated with like you know, just like random like fantasy figures or like sculpture, that kind of thing, just around the panel border to make it pretty. There's one early on that's like a naked bust of a woman, and I was like, oops, can't have this in a classroom. So, which kind of made me so sad, because I was like, otherwise this series I could have in my classroom, but that alone would make it a no-go.
Would make some parents just weird, just really weird. I also feel like there'd be a subset of parents that are like, this is satanic, what are you teaching our children? But for like 90% of well-adjusted people and well-adjusted parents, they'd be like, this is perfect for my child. This is no issue whatsoever.
To clarify, I live in Arizona.
I mean, that's not just an Arizona problem. Anyway.
America problem.
But, yeah, to that point, it's one that is, I think, for most apostrophe parents is very easy to feel comfortable with their kids reading. It's one as well that, again, the art style is just beautiful. Even for adult readers new to manga, people who are very into fantasy, whether that be, you know, people who grew up with Harry Potter, people who just read a lot of fantasy in general, who are wanting to dip their toes into comics, it's very approachable. I mean, obviously with manga, it's a bit of a learning curve, it seems. But it's one of those titles. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to say, like, it's a learning curve for a lot of adult readers to have to flip their books around and read them backwards. Mm-hmm. But I found that for kids, it is not these days. They'll read manga or a graphic novel and they won't even realize there's something different about them. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's as much of a hurdle for kids as some people think that it would be.
And I think this is a very, like, if you have a kid who's sort of the age of Coco and the other girls, or the other kids, I should say, and it's not just girls, that this is very well suited to them. There's not a lot of manga out there purely for kids anymore. There's teen stuff, and as I said, there's kind of different levels of what's acceptable for young readers in Japan versus the US. So even some of the, you know, our the titles we see coming from Shonen Jump and stuff, we're like, oh my god, why is there so much nudity and like just strange, this is not appropriate. This one is, it's not so young that it feels like it's for like really young primary school kids. It's not one that has in the same wheelhouse as like some of the Sanrio manga or Cheese Adventures or stuff like that, right? Or Pokemon.
Yuzu the Pet Vet.
Exactly. This is a little bit older, a little bit more mature, but not, you know, unapproachable for 10, 11, 12-year-olds who are probably going through a lot of the same stuff that, you know, these kids are, and which is, again, and it allows them to feel, you get caught up in a magical world, feel a little bit special, and it's even more of, like, because, again, growing up in the, like, the Potterverse, all kids wanted their owl letter at 11, right? Like, there's not a lot of kids who weren't like, oh, please, I just want, I want to go to Hogwarts, I want to be that special kid. Witch Hat Atelier tells you, you know, honestly, we're all special.
You can.
Anyone can be a witch.
Yeah.
You don't have to wait for that owl letter to come to you. You could be special right now. And that's really empowering as well.
Yeah. And also, you don't have to be good at homework like Hermione to be a good witch. Everybody has good witch traits. And it can be something simple. It could be that you're really good at drawing perfectly straight lines. And that's just as special as being really good at homework.
You don't have to be the chosen one.
And you need
one.
To treasure that. And when you're feeling all small and dark and sad, like you're not worth anything, you just remember that you're really good at drawing perfectly straight lines. Like... I thought that was so sweet. Like, sometimes you just need a reminder that, like, you don't have to be, like, this amazing superhuman to be special.
Special. Like, or just valued, full stop, right? Like, you are important, and the things you can do are important, no matter what they are. It's so sweet. It's so sweet.
And if you put yours and your friends' heads together, you can come up with something really amazing. Because you've all got different special talents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, Harry Potter hates fat people and people of color and queer people. And Witch Hat Atelier has all of those things in positive representations. So.
Yes. Yeah. And disabled people. Well, we can't forget disabled people.
We are getting to that. we have a whole question to answer about that.
I know.
And I figure we can talk about some of our main characters there a little more.
Mm-hmm.
But first, we have two questions from @TheMangaScholar. And the first one is, how does Witch Hat Atelier accurately reflect the dynamics of adolescent girlfriend groups? Not girlfriend groups, girlfriend groups. But, I mean, girlfriend groups also. Your girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
These are my girlfriends. Yeah, we already, we talked about this a bit when I was talking about, like, Agate. But I just think it's a really... The way that they bicker and then, like, come together stronger than ever, I think is really empowering. I like that it doesn't, like, it gets into the girls, like, having angst with each other, making each other feel insecure, you know, bullying each other when they are feeling particularly small. But the series doesn't, like, go for, like, the toxic girl drama.
Yeah.
like, oversimplification of things. You know, at the end of the day, the girls care about each other, and they want to be the best versions of themselves that they can be.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes messy feelings get in the way.
Yeah.
But in the end, their love for each other overcomes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's... more true to how, like, a genuine, like, positive friendship looks. I think it's a good model of healthy, positive friendship between girls. I like that, you know, it's not just the cute girls doing cute things who, like, never get mad at each other.
Yeah.
That you see a lot in manga.
Mm-hmm.
And instead they do get mad at each other. And they do hurt each other. And sometimes they hurt each other on purpose. And it's okay if they heal in the end. They apologize to each other and they
meet. And that's the thing, again, like, to facilitate why this is great for young readers, it kind of tells, especially young girls, right? Like, it's girls just generally in society are told, like, you can't have these negative feelings or to feel bad about being mean to, like, all sorts of things. To feel bad about their jealousy, they're upset, they have to feel approachable and kind and whatever to everyone, which is not how girls work, because we are,
mm-hmm.
you know, we have a range of emotions, thank you very much. But I think something that says to girls, especially preteen girls, who are in this messy period of hormones and growing up and trying to figure themselves out as well, it's really, really important that a series says, you know, it's okay that you feel upset or hurt or jealous or whatever, that someone else can, like, one of these other girls has a better than you or can do something better than you or is, you know, more popular than you. You're allowed to feel upset about that. You're allowed to feel hurt about that. And even if you are mean about it, or even if you don't react to that in the best way, as long as you recognize that that was wrong, you're still a good person. It doesn't make you any less
mm-hmm.
of a good kid. Kids have really messy emotions, yeah. right? And, oh, do we know?
It's like, it doesn't make what you did okay,
mm-hmm.
but it also, like, what you did doesn't define you. You're not yeah. a bad person because you're you did something bad. You're not
reprehensible or unforgivable. You're a kid who's learning how mm. to figure themselves out. And sometimes, even adults feel jealous and bad and upset over other people sometimes. And sometimes they handle it way worse than kids do. So
yeah, they don't have an excuse.
And they don't have an excuse. and they're way less likely to apologize and, you know, reform the friendship.
But I also think, that, like, you know, if an adult does something to hurt you and, like, mm-hmm. they don't, like, come to you to, like, talk about it and apologize, like, it's okay not to, like, forgive them for that.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Like,
it's okay to not trust them anymore mm-hmm. after they've proven themselves to be untrustworthy. But also, like, by the other token is, like, that if you have, like, a trustworthy, hopefully you have some trustworthy adults in your life,
mm-hmm.
and that you should feel like you can go to them with your, you know, messy, big feelings and talk about it. Like, you shouldn't feel afraid to just be a preteen
mm-hmm.
to the adults who have been entrusted with your care.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't make you feel small for yeah. being who you are.
The adults who care about you and the adults that you should hopefully be able to trust won't think you're a bad person if you make a mistake or do something wrong. They won't hate you. They might tell you that what you know, that you've made a mistake and that you need to apologize, or that there's way talk through it with you to help you figure out some of those emotions in the best course of action
and figure out how to make it right.
Exactly. But they're not going to say, okay, well, you're just a bad kid forever, and how could you disappoint me like this, and well, I guess there's nothing we can do, you're just hopeless and useless. Sorry, did I bring up some trauma there?
I'm just crying over you, Eni, again.
Yeah, I know. Oh, God.
Baby boy.
So, yeah, I mean, that's, I think we've gone a little off pace from the original question, but really good friend group with a really good mentor, really good guidance from people that they trust and who want to protect and help them, right?
Mm-hmm. who want to see them grow into the best versions of themselves. Okay, the other question from at the manga scholar, who is Black Manga Critic also. Mm-hmm. I didn't say that earlier, but on a scale of 1 to 10, how well does Witch Hat Atelier explore disability? I don't feel comfortable putting it on a scale because mm-hmm. I personally am not a person with a disability,
mm-hmm.
Or any disabilities. So, like, I feel like that is something to be, I don't want to say quantified, but, like, you know, I feel like that's something that you should really be listening to, like, readers with disabilities mm-hmm. on more so mm-hmm. than us. But we can certainly, like, talk about the presence of disability within the series mm-hmm. and our own personal experience with reading about it. It's certainly, like, disability is not something that gets a... It is more so now, but I think a lot in, like, shoujo and josei,
mm-hmm.
more so than, like, and shoujo and josei, like, romance and slice mm-hmm. of life, more so mm-hmm. than, like, more fantastical, like, genre fiction type of stuff. So, like, we're getting stuff like Sign of Affection or A Perfect World. But you don't see a lot of, like, fantasy series that are dealing a lot with disability in manga.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Witch Hat Atelier really does. I would say it's, like, a core theme of the series. Well, specifically, I think, like, difference is mm-hmm. A core theme of the series. And that includes, you know, various types of, like, disabilities, as well as, like, accessibility mm-hmm. And equity are big core themes of the series. But yeah, that was me saying a lot of things really fast. We've got several characters with disabilities in the series.
Mm-hmm. I also... Before we get into, like, specific disabled characters, I just want to echo that I am with Ray in that I'm not comfortable, like, speaking as an expert on disability, and especially disability in manga as a able-bodied person. So it's not, you know, this is not our topic to be championing, but when it comes to disability representation in, as Ray said, like, actual magical or fantastical settings, and again, I keep bringing up the Harry Potter comparison, but, like, that, there's, disability just doesn't exist. Mental health, you go to the you know, the hospital for that and you never get out, but any actual, like, physical disability is just like, well, magic will fix it. Whereas mm-hmm. because of the fundamental aspect in this series of, like, magic upon the human body is forbidden, we just don't do that. Any witch who's found doing that will just go to the gulag, and is evil. It opens up this whole new perspective of, well, we actually do have the ability to change people's bodies and quote unquote fix disabilities. Is it morally right to do so? And should it be something that is normalized and accepted? Further to that as well, I wanted to make the comparison to something that does, I guess, have a magic system. It's not called magic, but plays with a similar theme, and that's Fullmetal Alchemist. The idea of, like, the reason human transmutation isn't something that's accepted, or
I was encouraged. Literally about to say, Witch Hat Atelier says human transmutation.
Yes.
Good, actually.
Good, actually? And in Full Metal Alchemist, like, it's very clear as to, over the course of the story, like, the why human transmutation, whilst able to be done, isn't, like, the sacrifice is greater than what you achieve with it because of the equivalent exchange idea, and how do you value, or, like, how do you quantify the value of human life, or mm-hmm. a soul or whatever. Which makes, like, disability in that manga very interesting as well. But with this series, it's a topic that comes up a lot because we do have several disabled characters. And with magic, if there was far less scruples, or if, you know, the days of yore hadn't happened, there would probably be a lot more people without disability, right? Like, there is, magic is able to quote-unquote fix disability to a certain extent, and is that good or a bad thing for society? That's mm-hmm. a very pointed question that gets played around with a lot, and that Coco is kind of currently having to struggle with. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, we get sort of this idea that it's like, we're starting to sort of get into that there were some earlier, like, stories that really got into this, but I think now we're going to get into it into the woods deeper and deeper, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. as it were. But the idea that what's wrong isn't, like, people who have disabilities or differences,
mm-hmm.
That are needing to be fixed, but the world that is made by people who never thought about problems that they had never had.
Uh-huh.
that is what is needing to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
We have a character who lost the function of his legs,
mm-hmm.
Early in the series. And sort of the first solution that Coco and Tarta try to help him, he has, like, a mobility aid, yeah. which is, they call it a seal chair, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's got a magical seal, but it's like a wheelchair, but it's got four hooves instead of wheels, and it's delightfully silly. he's still struggling a lot because, like, if the ground gets too steep or the terrain gets too difficult, like, his chair can't traverse that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, probably, like, the reason that, like, you know, the cobblestones here are not accessible to someone using a seal chair is because witches don't have to worry about walking at all. They have magic shoes that let them fly.
Yeah.
So they're like, well, isn't that unfair to begin with? That, mm-hmm. like, people who have never experienced, like, you know, having to think about the ground beneath their feet at all because they can fly,
mm-hmm.
Are the ones who made the ground
yeah.
beneath their feet. So we get talking about, like, universal design and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also going to say, I wanted to mention that the character is with two exceptions,
mm-hmm.
I think. Our characters with disabilities are characters who were not born with those yes. disabilities. Yeah. And in general, it's like missing, like, function particular body parts.
And to that initial example that you gave, part of the reason why this character is struggling with the seal chair and his loss of mobility is because he was a dancer. Like, it completely changed his life and his perception of self. And he's young, so he's still, like, getting over that as well. So there's a lot of, like, emotional stuff going on there, which is, to that point, there's a big difference in how people who are born with a disability and then those who become disabled later in life perceive their disability, or at least kind of understand themselves as disabled. So that's another nuance that isn't really covered in even other manga that talk about disability or have disabled characters.
Well, but also I would say, like, that is sort of a almost blind spot of the series, where it is primarily interested in characters who were not born with their disability and whose disabilities are not genetic, who specifically, like, got into specific accidents that caused them to have a particular disability, which is also going to affect how they perceive their own disability in terms of, like, trauma, right? Like, they're gonna, you know, this character associates the loss of the function in his legs not only with, you know, losing his ability to make a living as a dancer, but also with, like, this super traumatic singular event in his past, right? And that's certainly true of, like, Kifri is another character who he, like, I don't think it's particularly a spoiler that he's got one eye. It's just his character design. he's missing an eye. And he is very, very mad about it because he is also losing the function of his other eye. That is a spoiler. And, like, he is very, like, bitter and cynical about this because, like, it was something that was very consciously taken from him by, like, bad actors in his life. So, and again, like, that's going to be a very different, perspective that he's going to have towards his failing eyesight compared to someone who maybe has a genetic condition causing that
blindness.
Maybe they've known
or
about
visionless.
For a long time.
And
they kind of have known for a long time that, like, eventually their eyesight's going to go. And, like, there's bitterness to it, but it's a different bitterness, you know? So I think that this series has a lot of representation for a particular experience of dealing with disabilities, but, like, it is very focused on, like, that one type of experience. With the exception of Belderoot, who we don't really know how he lost function in his legs. He just doesn't have function in his legs, so he has an even cooler seal chair with horns for armrests.
It is a very cool seal chair. I'm very jealous.
And
I
he just wanders around, and it's great. We do see him struggling with, like, he's got, you know, a lot of the issues that can come along with paralysis. But in general, we see him sort of whimsically cajoling around in his awesome chair. So love that. And then there's Tarta, who has, like, a fantasy version of color blindness, where he seems to see the world. They say he sees the world in a wash of silver, so to me, I interpret that as he sees the world in black and white. But this is very bad for an aspiring witch candidate, because color is a huge part of magic.
because magic is art and it's drawing. And for people with his condition, they're kind of just like assumed to be completely useless to the world of magic.
They assume that they will never be able to tell, like, differentiate certain things without the ability to see color. Which is is proven wrong throughout, like, through that kind of small character arc.
And specifically we see him sort of finding a way around, you know, not being able to see colors, through developing for himself a, accommodation, like, assistive technology for himself. And it's very sweet, and he is, well on his way to becoming an apprentice now, which is very cute. But I like that recurring idea of, like, if there's something that I can't do, then I'm gonna figure out how I can, kind of thing. Yeah.
Nothing is impossible. You just gotta find a way to figure it out. You gotta adapt. Yeah.
And, you know, one big way to do that is to, like, actually make the world more accessible. Adapt the world to the people who are living in it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I think, like, in terms of overall themes, like, you know, we're getting a lot of the stuff that's, like, very core to, like, disability rights. So with, like, universal design, with, like, you know, not problematizing disability, but problematizing a world that does not accommodate for different kinds of people.
Yeah.
I think that stuff is huge. I think that certainly, like, the upper elementary age kids that I've worked with, like, if you teach them about things like universal design, they are so gung-ho about it more than anyone else in the world. Because they're just at this perfect age to just want to go out and set the world on fire and make it better. And I think that I think that it's the perfect age to introduce ideas like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that this series deals with them so much. All right. So our last question is from friend of the show at Sunlit Lake. The series runs in the Seinen magazine Morning 2. However, over here it's usually advertised as being for girls ages 10 plus, which is the shoujo market. Why do you think that is? What is different about the marketing and target audience research in Japan that is different to the West? And then they add, to clarify, I don't think it's weird for the series to be advertised to either of these demographics. Girls want to read about being a witch. Men have daughters, nieces, baby sisters, etc., who they love and adore and want to read about mentor and mentee relationships that mirror that. So yeah, the series runs in a seinen magazine, Morning 2, in Japan, but it's generally advertised to, like, you know, younger, especially girls here in the States and also other English-speaking countries and territories. I have a screed for this. What do you think, G?
I know the topic of your screed, and I agree with the topic of your screed. I am just gonna say that before you get into the screed, that as said, I think the reason that we have it advertised as a series, usually advertised as a series for that young female demographic, is for the reasons that we've already discussed. Very strong female empowerment, especially for young girls. It's very magical. It has a really appealing world and theme for those, you know, kids who like the idea of magic and escapism. It's the same, you know, it's the same excitement that, again, I hate keep coming back to it, but 20 years ago, all of us 10, 11-year-olds were having with Harry Potter, right? Like, it is, it appeals to those same core ideas of, like, oh, magic is so cool and fun and interesting and, for lack of a better word, magical. Look at the all the amazing stuff that can happen and, like, this crazy, amazing adventures that, like, these kids are going on. Oh my gosh. And maybe the kids will save the day. There's a big, bad, evil, you know, person, villain, and our plucky protagonist will save the day. Mm-hmm. Whether your version of that
with her ideas.
With her ideas. Whether that your version of that was Harry Potter or Percy Jackson or any of the myriad of other, like, magical chosen one kid lit fiction out there, it's all the same. Like, I love adventure. I want, my normal life is so freaking boring. All I've got is math homework and piano practice. I want to go on magical adventures. And so that is why it's marketed to young preteens, especially in the English-speaking market.
It's about little witch girls,
mm-hmm,
learning about magic and saving the world. So it is marketed to little girls who want to be little witch girls, who learn magic and save the world.
Yes.
Yeah, so my screed, I call it that, but it's not actually all that long, because mm-hmm, it's pretty simple. It's just that I think that a lot of English-speaking manga readers have this fundamental misunderstanding about what seinen as a label means. Mm-hmm. In Japan, these days, in the year of our Lord, 2024, right? you know, I'm not talking about, like, Gekiga manga in the 80s. Yeah. I'm talking about now. Bookstores, now.
Yes.
And the fact is that, you know, wherever you go in terms of, like, publishing, in terms of media, stuff that is quote-unquote for girls is a specialty product, and stuff that is quote-unquote for boys or men is a general audience's product.
Yeah.
Seinen is a general audience's label.
Yes.
Like, if there's no other label to put on it, you can just call it seinen.
Uh-huh. If it doesn't,
that's why all the artsy fartsy magazines are also uh-huh seinen. Like, all of the specialty magazines that are, like, very targeted towards a particular interest set, a lot of those are seinen.
Yes.
Because it's a general audience's label.
It's why all of the manga that, like, don't quite fit into the shoujo or seinen or josei categories are seinen manga. You know, it's like,
it's not like, ew, gross old men reading about little girls. It's like, no, it's just kind of aimed at everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, it's not that it's not aimed at, you know, preteen girls. They might pick it up, but it's...
Which Hat Atelier runs in the same magazine that Devil's Line and its sequel runs in. It runs in mm-hmm the same magazines as Sensei's Pious Lie. It runs in the same magazine as bloody My Brother the Shut-In. Like, this is the none of these works. It ran in the same magazine as Shonen Note, right? Like,
Shonen Note.
There
literally
is...
like, I have the list open, and it's like, we've got, like, 11:22 for a happy marriage, which anyone would guess is a fucking Jose. No.
No.
Cells at Work lady, so one of the Cells at Work spinoffs.
Yeah. We've Saint got, Young Men.
Like, Saint Young Men. We've got, yeah, like, I was just looking at one that was, I have to figure out which one I was looking at. Like, Hiraya, so, like, yeah. Other Kamatani Yuki manga. Like, it's just, like, it's got a mix of things. Because it's she, her camera, and her seasons. I was looking at that one. That's another, like, wistful, kind of slightly artsy romance type of thing. It's like, there's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff.
It's one of those, it's one of those magazines that, like, at any point in time, you pick up the most recent issue, and there's, you know, a beautiful, exciting, adventurous chapter of Witch Hat Atelier, and then 30 pages down, there's the newest, just harrowing chapter of Devil's Line 2, and that's fine. That's normal.
Heaven's Design Team runs in this, which is another one that gets marketed to kids in English. Because it's educational. Just like Cells at Work is educational, and it's marketed to kids a lot. But it's technically seinen.
And then you flip
But I'm not going to say it's a bad manga for kids. It's,
yeah.
You know, it teaches them about cells. Okay, so,
yeah,
that's my screed. That's me on my soapbox.
I just also want to add to that as well, is that seinen, as you said, in Japan is such a catch-all term, and is used to group pretty much anything else, any manga that doesn't fit into the other categories or demographics, right? But also, I think seinen, when we're talking about, like, Western fandom and community, has become such a, like, I don't want to say poisoned term, but, like, man, male fans are so weird about things being seinen or not seinen.
Yeah.
And
for sure. They're like, seinen is, like, the goat, and nothing else is worth reading.
Seinen.
It's like, okay.
They're truly today, when I logged onto the hell site that was Twitter, there's been a image that people are dunking on, and you sent it to me, Ray, of, like, it's got Vagabond, it's got Berserk, and it's got Vinland Saga, so those three, the main characters of those three manga, it's like, oh, those protagonists
those three
are the
manga
goat.
That never deserved this treatment.
Those are three perfectly good manga. I have read all three. I enjoy them. They are good. They do not deserve the fans that they have. It is impossible to tell you how unnuanced the discussion around seinen, and especially, like, gritty, dark seinen, quote-unquote, for big boys manga. It's just so reductive, and it's comical because it's very reflective of, like, the fact that they don't read anything else, and even other seinen manga that isn't the Berserk or Vinland Saga or Gantz or, I don't know, they're just like, no, that's obviously a girl kissing shoujo manga, and you're like, well, actually, no, that's not how that works. That's just not how it works. And they would refuse to touch it. But, of course, you can't argue with them because they don't actually... It's not a good faith interaction anyway, so it's not even worth doing. The point is that I think seinen is perceived in Western fandom, and it's not just, like, English-speaking territories. I think it's across the board. But Western fandom is so poisoned by this, like, has to be very hyper masculine, dark, got the just the male protagonist, big sword guy, gonna save the world, gets all the girls, and just fucking is the best ever, and that sword isn't compensating for anything. And if it becomes quiet and sentimental and reflective for 1 minute, then either half of the fan base says, well, this just fucking fell off. Oh my god, what happened? This is the worst thing ever. This mangaka doesn't know how to tell a story. And then the other half just says, oh my god, this just shows that it's even more brilliant than any of those other stupid series that don't have a quiet moment of reflection. You know, mate, have you ever read one thing? Have you ever read one thing that isn't this series?
Read another book.
Oh my god. So,
speaking of Harry Potter.
Exactly. In many ways, they are very similar, these fan bases. So,
oh god.
The overall point is that seinen manga, I think, has a very complicated, I don't even say, it's not complicated, it's very straightforward.
Perception.
But it has a very unfortunate misperception in the West of being a very specific type of series, and it's not the case. And I am too old and wizened by
too
the
jaded.
Perils of social media to get into the debates about what constitutes shoujo and shonen, and so I don't care. I don't fucking care. It really shouldn't matter. But also, there is like a discussion there. It's important to discuss, but I'm not having these fights anymore. I will leave it to the younger people with more energy. I just know, because it's a never-ending fight. You're never going to win the war. You're never going to, there's always going to be a new idiot you have to argue with.
You gotta just, you gotta pick your battles.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
My battle today is saying that Witch Hat Atelier runs in a seinen magazine, because most manga are classified as seinen.
Yes.
And that's it. That's all I wanted to say.
Yes. And regardless of if you're a 47-year-old man or a 12-year-old girl, if you want a magical story about whimsy and magic and friendship, read Witch Hat Atelier. It doesn't matter. Read it. It's good. It's worth reading. It won an Eisner. Read it. Regardless of demographics, regardless of, I don't know if I could read something with a female protagonist, read the fucking manga. That's it.
Yeah. It's your favorite kind of manga. It's seinen.
Mm.
The "you're" in question here, not referring to Asker, and friend of the show at Sunlit Lake, by the way.
Yes. No, we would never do that.
The general you.
General you. Always a general you. We although we may speak pointedly, directly sometimes, never singling out one person.
Sunlit Lake also made the excellent point that, people of many different demographics would find enjoyable things and relatable things within a series like Witch Hat Atelier.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Good series.
And with that, I think we've come to the end of all of our questions. Have we not?
Yep.
Yay.
What are we talking about next month, G?
Next month. It is May. And that means that it is time for our annual novel spotlight. Our light novel reading corner. Whatever it is that we called this last time.
light novel corner or something.
Yes, something like that. But next month we will be talking about the light novel series. One of the, like, I guess very early light novel series available in English, and with a, I think, a renewed interest because it has just recently gotten a new anime. We'll be talking about Spice and Wolf. Notably.
Yay.
I mean, well, I'm sure top or discussion will happen or that I'll be able to speak to the wider series as a whole, but just the first volume. I am not subjecting Ray to read 22 and ongoing volumes plus a 5-volume ongoing sequel. Where I'm not doing that to her. I we'll stick to the first volume.
First one.
But
first
Spice and Wolf,
taste.
Yes. The novel that really spawned a massive franchise that is, as mentioned, still ongoing to this day. So, be sure to,
I think,
give us all your questions. We'll post about it on Twitter. You can also leave questions in the comments of the YouTube version of this podcast. If you have enjoyed this, as mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, you can follow us on every podcasting platform out there. Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, maybe others. I don't know. We're out there. As well as on my YouTube channel, Simply G. You can also find us on social media. The site formerly known as Twitter, you can find me at G, that's G-double-E underscore reads. And be sure to follow Ray at her Twitter, nay, X, at WhimsicalPix, that's P-I-X. All one word, because we hang out there, even though the world is burning.
Yep.
So.
I think in the spirit of things, I should try and find a physical copy of Spice and Wolf Volume 1 that is specifically that hideous photographic cover.
Yeah, the... I will tell you now, my first copy, well, I think my still, it's the only copy I have, my copy of the first volume had that cover, but I think by the time I had gotten it, they'd wisened up, and they'd made that version a slip cover, like dust jacket, so underneath is the weeby, like, normal illustrated cover. So
that's even funnier, though. That's objectively the funniest possible thing you could have done.
I love it. It's so good. I don't think I have that dust jacket anymore, because why would I? But, you know.
I would keep it forever. I would treasure it.
If I like find it right, child. I will ship it to you directly.
Things G has shipped me. A copy of 4 shoujo stories with one of my favorite short stories of all time in it. Mm. And the hideous live action dust cover jacket of the first Spice and Wolf novel.
Truly a treasure. But yes, if you have any questions about traveling salesman Lawrence and his traveling partner, the Wise Wolf Holo, be sure to send them our way. Otherwise, we will see you in the next episode. Bye till then.
Bye, guys.